This is Barry Tyker of the Oral History Project. Today is October 28th, 1994. This is interview three in my series with Ted Finman. I'm sitting with Ted in his office on the fourth floor of the law building on a rather chilly late October day. Yeah. Today we're going to talk about governance. Could you discuss the faculty governance system as it was in place when you became involved in the university committee?
Sure. Faculty governance operates at a variety of levels on the campus. If we're talking about the university committee, then we're talking about faculty governance at the campus level. At the campus level, the university committee, which consists of six faculty elected by the faculty at large for three-year terms, two each year, so that two people are turning over every year. University committee is the executive committee of the faculty. And it is the executive committee of the faculty senate, which is also an elected body. One senate member for each 10 faculty, these people being elected at the departmental level, so that each department has one senator for every 10 faculty members in the department, or major fraction thereof. University committee's charge is just extremely broad to deal with any issues of importance to the faculty. It will typically bring important issues to the Senate for the Senate's consideration, often with some sort of recommendation from the university committee itself, sometimes simply for discussion. University committee also works with other elected and appointed faculty committees that handle issues of campus-wide importance. Do you have any particular questions about, campus level?
Yeah. How are issues referred to you? Do the chancellors come and refer issues to you? Do you just sort of
in all kinds
issues?
Of ways. Sometimes the administration will bring a problem to the university committee. Sometimes faculty will bring a problem to the university committee. Sometimes the university committee, on its own initiative, will say to itself, here's a problem we need to worry about.
In your time on the committee, who was chancellor? Young.
Ed Young.
Ed Young was chancellor. What kind of a working relationship did the committee have with Young? Was there ever a problem with faculty stepping on administration toes or vice versa?
Only once. Generally speaking, the relationship was very cordial and comfortable, and Ed Young took great pains to promote that sort of relationship. I think this had been his practice in the past, I'm not quite sure, but very, very shortly after I was elected chair of the university committee, Ed established a weekly lunch with me where I would go in and have lunch with Ed in his office, and on nice days sometimes we'd walk around the campus. There was no particular agenda, just to talk about whatever either one of us wanted to talk about, and if there wasn't any business, just to chat about this and that. And he was very good at this sort of thing, a very good administrator.
So essentially what the university committee, this may sound simplistic, you dealt with essentially faculty issues. You were just faculty oriented?
I'm not sure what you mean.
I'm not sure
by
what
that.
You mean either.
We dealt with issues that were of importance to the faculty.
Okay. How did you decide when an issue was something that you wanted to accept rather than keep your hands off of?
Well, we wouldn't have been talking about it at all unless some of us thought it was significant to the faculty, and then there might be some discussion about whether this was a matter that was worth taking time with. Okay. So if there was any question about whether it was something appropriate for us to worry about, we'd talk about that, make a decision on that. Most often, it would have been fairly self-evident that the matter was important for the faculty.
You said that there were other levels of government operating on campus, faculty governance, rather. Could you discuss those?
Yeah, at a very, very important level, many people would say perhaps the most important level would be governance at the departmental level, questions having to do with hiring and tenure and curriculum and all of these very basic educational issues are handled by faculty at the departmental level for the most part. And then of course there's governance at the school or college level. There's divisional committee governance, which deals primarily with making recommendations to the dean in instances in which a department recommends tenure. The divisional committee reviews that and makes a recommendation to the dean.
We will be talking about that a little bit later on. You were on the social side.
And then there are all kinds of campus level committees besides the university committee that deal with specific problem areas, like the admissions policy committee or the student conduct policy committee, the affirmative action committee, and so on.
I've heard many people I've interviewed and many other campus people say one of the real strengths of the UW-Madison is its system of faculty governance. It's system of governance. Does this, to your knowledge, does this system differ from the way most other universities that you're familiar with are governed?
Well, I'm really not that familiar with the structures at other universities.
Right.
It certainly is the belief on this campus that we are almost unique, but lots of places tend to feel that about themselves. And I suspect that there are other institutions that have very strong established governance structures, not different in their strength than ours, but I'm sure that the number of institutions across the country that have really strong faculty participation in governance is relatively small. So we're probably among an elite group, though not unique.
Let's go to your own involvement in faculty governance. It did not start, of course, with the university committee. You had participated in governance matters before then. Starting where, with the committee level, would that be?
Yeah, I think my first involvement was on the Social Studies Divisional Committee. The law school's part of the Social Studies Division. And I don't remember exactly what year, but it wasn't too long after I had arrived here that the law school people wanted me to serve on the Divisional Committee. So I ran for that and was elected and served, I think, the usual 3-year term on the Social Studies Divisional Committee. What happened after that? Well, you know, I'm just not sure. There, I served as chair of the Student Conduct Hearing Committee, and I think that was before the University Committee.
Yeah, I believe it was. What is the Student Conduct Hearing Committee?
Well, at that time, it was the committee that was an adjudicative committee where students were charged with misconduct, and I believe that this committee was limited to non-academic misconduct. And that was in the 60s, the late 60s or early 70s, where there were all kinds of problems, as you know. So if a student was charged with misconduct and was contesting the charge, then this was an adjudicative committee. As I recall, there were three faculty members, and we held hearings where the evidence pro and con and arguments pro and con would be presented, and we would make decisions about whether the student was guilty of the misconduct.
Were a lot of these incidents related to the Vietnam War protests?
Oh, yeah.
What?
There weren't a huge number, but...
What were some of the kinds of issues that would come in front of the committee?
Well, they would mainly be factual issues, disputes about whether the student had actually done what was charged.
You mean like breaking windows or...
Yeah, I don't remember the specific instances.
And what were the kind of penalties that would come out of this if the student was found guilty of these, whatever he was charged with?
My recollection is very hazy on that, too. And I'm not sure whether the committee had final authority on that matter or whether we made a recommendation to the administration. I'm really not sure.
When you became a member of the Student Conduct Hearing Committee, what was the normal way for professors to make their way onto committees? Were you appointed? Did you volunteer to be on the committee? How did that come about?
There would have been basically two ways, either appointment or election, and some committees were designated. The process in some committees was election and in others appointment, and I don't remember what was the case on student conduct policy.
So the appointment would come maybe through the Faculty Senate?
No.
Through the University Committee?
At that time, it might have come through the University Committee, or it might have come through the Chancellor's Office.
Okay.
Those would have been the two typical ways of appointing people to committees.
Now, I could see how you would be appointed to this committee because you were in law school.
Right.
Was that normally the case that they try to match people up to their types of...
where a committee could use certain kinds of competences mm-hmm. that were peculiar to a discipline, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think almost always there was someone from the law school on this committee, and not unusual to have someone from the law school be chair.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, let's go back to the Social Sciences Divisional Committee for just a moment. Again, you explained earlier that you handled mainly tenure decisions, personnel decisions.
Right.
Did you work with the departments would make the recommendations and they'd be passed on to you? Was the secretary of the faculty department involved in this office?
Actually, the department makes a recommendation to the dean.
To the dean, right.
And then the dean refers it to the divisional mm-hmm. committee. And the relationship of the secretary of the faculty's office is that office provided the staff support for the divisional committees. So there was a person from the secretary of the faculty's office. I mean, this is as it's been in contemporary times. I don't remember mm-hmm. what it was when I was on the Social Studies Divisional Committee, because the secretary of the faculty's office at that time was much smaller in terms of personnel than it has been for some time now.
Who was the secretary of the faculty?
I believe that Bill Loomer was at that time.
And he was part-time faculty.
Yes, mm-hmm. right.
Any other, before we get to the university committees, any other committees or governance type situations you were involved with?
There may have been. I don't remember right offhand.
You said two people were elected every year, and it was a rotating committee. There were mm-hmm. six people total. How did you get involved? How were you elected? Were you selected? Or
For faculty elected committees, at that time there was a nominating committee, which was itself elected by the faculty, and the nominating committee would go out and solicit people to stand for election for elected committees. And I was asked to run for the committee and agreed.
Is just for the mechanics of it, for historical sake of history here, there were six of you. You met in the same room every week. Who was all in the room? How were the meetings structured? Do you recall?
There would be the six members of the committee, and sometimes the chancellor would come in, or vice chancellor would come in to talk about something. These are open meetings. Generally speaking, they're open meetings. I don't remember whether the secretary of the faculty would come to those meetings or not. I don't think so. Mm-hmm. If someone had a problem that they wanted to bring to the university committee, that person would come for that part of the meeting. Sometimes the committee would ask people to come to discuss something that the committee wanted to take up. The structure is very flexible. The only thing that was really set is that the six of us would meet every Monday afternoon at that time.
Did this committee take up a lot of time?
Oh yeah, especially when I became chair. But it took up every Monday afternoon, mm-hmm. and then whatever tasks one had as a member of the committee, because you know, work was divided out among the members, so it's very time-consuming.
So it might mean going to the Board of Regents, for example, meetings, or
yes.
Going to the legislature or researching.
Working on some particular project that the university committee was working on. It could be subcommittees, which could involve other faculty, just all kinds of things.
Turn this off. Ted just mentioned that an area we didn't cover, that the faculty senate was created in the early 70s, and it used to be all faculty meetings where decisions were made. Could you discuss why the senate, why there was a need for the senate?
Well, first of all, attendance at faculty meetings, which were open to all faculty, and everybody, any faculty member had one vote if they came to the meeting. Attendance fluctuated substantially, and at most meetings was not terribly high. So there was a judgment that in order to have a more representative body with greater participation, it would be better to have a representative body rather than a kind of town meeting structure. And of course there was some concern that it would be relatively easy to pack a faculty meeting, any group that was interested in a particular issue. Now, if they could mobilize 20 or 30 people to come to that meeting, it would have a substantial impact. Whereas if you had a representative body where the particular individuals who were members of the Senate would have a sense of responsibility to attend, special responsibility to attend, there wouldn't be that kind of problem.
Using modern terminology here, were there term limits established for the people who represented the...
When the Senate was created, one of the provisions of the bylaws, as I recall, was that a person could not serve more than three terms, and terms, as I remember, were 2 years, mm-hmm. Except in special circumstances if the department really couldn't find someone else willing to be a senator, enough people to fill their slots.
Have there been any issues since that you can recall offhand since the beginning of the faculty senate where the entire senate was convened, the entire faculty was convened for various issues? I'm thinking of the ROTC thing, but I don't recall if that was or not.
I think that's right. I think there have been a couple of all faculty meetings on hot issues, but beyond that very vague recollection, I don't really recall.
In your opinion, was the movement toward a faculty senate a good movement?
Yeah, I think that's a much better way of getting faculty input into governance. Senate meetings are usually pretty well attended. There's a quorum requirement, and there's seldom any problem with a quorum. And you can't pack a Senate meeting as a practical matter. And I do believe that, you know, there's an old adage, if everybody is responsible, nobody's responsible. Mm-hmm. So under the prior system, since no one had any particular responsibility, it wasn't anybody's job to come to a faculty meeting. It was very haphazard. And you'd get the relatively small group of people who had more interest than the others, who would be habitual attenders. And occasionally, if an issue was exciting, more people would come. But it wasn't in any way representative of the faculty at large, whereas the Senate really is. And I think people who agree to be senators, do have a sense of responsibility to come to the meetings and participate.
Good. Okay. You were on the university committee for 3 years. You were a chair for 2 years. Before I move any further than that, normally you're a chair for 1 year. How did you end up being a chair for 2 years? Do you recall?
Well, I know you wanted to ask that, and I've tried to remember just how things develop, and my recollection is a little bit hazy, but I'll tell you what I can recall. I was elected to the university committee to serve initially for the 1973-1974 academic year. And the next, I was elected chair the next academic year, 1974-75. Ordinarily, someone who is serving in their third year would have been elected chair. And ordinarily, there would be two people serving in their third year. In that second year of my term on the university committee, 74-75, the two people who, there was only one person who may have been in his third year, and that was John Harriman. And the other person who would have been in his third year had taken leave from the university for that year, so an individual, Jane Hutchison, was, I believe, appointed and confirmed by the Senate to fill in. So she wouldn't have been a candidate because this would have been her first year, and indeed it was her only year on the university committee, as the record seems to indicate. I don't remember why John did not become chair. It may be that was really only John's second year. It may be that for 73-74, he had been appointed to fill someone's vacancy. So he and I were on a par in that respect, in that 74-5 would have been the second year for both of us. The other person who would have been on a par with me in terms of service was Arthur Kelman, who had been elected at the same time that I was. And Arthur had other things, other obligations that he felt precluded him from being chair. So he declined even to be considered. And the committee chose me rather than John Harriman. I don't remember whether John had indicated that he would have preferred not to be or not. I just don't remember that. And then for 75-76, Arthur Kellman and I were in our third year, and Arthur again wasn't interested in being chair, and I think the rest of the people who had been there the year before felt that I was doing a good job and were happy to have me continue. Actually, I told the committee members when they asked me if I would be chair that I would, provided that Ed Young felt that the relationship had between us had been a good one. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any specific reason to doubt that, but I wanted to make sure about that. So I talked to Ed about it, and he indicated that he had enjoyed the relationship excuse me, the prior year, and be quite happy to have it continue that way. So I was quite delighted to continue. I enjoyed the work.
Speaking of the work, let's get to the work. What were some of the major issues that you confronted in your 3 years on the university committee?
Well, collective bargaining for faculty was a hot issue, I think, throughout that period, and indeed continued to be an issue for a while until, you know, external support for it really waned, and there was no longer enough support for us to worry about it seriously. The leadership of the Madison faculty, and I think by far the vast majority of Madison faculty were opposed to collective bargaining for faculty. This would have been true for the other institutions, the other campuses that had been part of the Chapter 36 system prior to merger, as Milwaukee, Green Bay,
Parkside,
right. Whereas the Chapter 37 institutions, the TALF, which was their sort of semi-union but without any status to bargain, it was an unofficial voluntary membership organization. TALF, TALF stands for the Association of University Faculty, something like that. TALF was ardently in favor of collective bargaining because it wanted to be the bargaining agent for all of those campuses. In any event, this was a real struggle between Madison and the other former 36 institutions, Chapter 36 institutions on the one side, and the TALF campuses on the other. And you know, the idea of collective bargaining generally is a good one and has widespread support and had a fair amount of legislative support. TALF had some reasonable chance of being able to get enough legislative support to pass a bill which would have authorized faculty collective bargaining. So it was a hot issue in the sense that it was perceived by us as a real threat and by TALF as a real possibility. Other issues,
shall we just continue
on collective bargaining, because there's a lot that related to that.
We'll just kind of knock down one at a time.
Okay,
here.
That's fine.
When did the university committee get involved in that issue, and in what way?
Oh, the university committee was involved in that issue well before I was a member. I remember one Senate meeting, and I don't recall which year, but not too long before I joined, when the university committee brought to the Faculty Senate a resolution opposing collective bargaining, as I recall, except on certain specified conditions, which would have protected Madison and would have protected other would have made the decision be it one at the individual campus level rather than in any sense a system by faculty at the system level, and would have protected governance and so on. And Gordon Baldwin and I offered a motion at the Senate to modify that, to make the motion not quite as anti-collective bargaining as it was, and that amendment was defeated, and the University Committee's resolution was adopted by the Faculty Senate. And it continued to be, hot issue when I, or I should put it differently, it was a hot issue and had continued to be to the time, at the time I joined the University Committee, was throughout my tenure on the committee and afterward as well. At the time, at the time I joined the University Committee, the overall strategy on our part, was to try and get some agreement with TALF on provisions in a bill which would safeguard what we saw as our own interests and the interests of other campuses that didn't want to bargain collectively and wanted to have the power not to bargain if they so chose, and in addition to protect governance across the board from interference by collective bargaining, to prevent collective bargaining from being able to abolish or seriously interfere with the then existing governance structure, governance rights. As you can tell from the minutes of the University Committee, there were times when we thought we could reach such an agreement with TALF. Because you see, if we could reach an agreement with TALF on what should go into a bill, and they would agree to these provisions, and we would agree not to oppose the bill, it would have sailed through the legislature without any problem whatsoever. And you know, we were concerned that even if we opposed the bill, it might be passed. So that was our incentive to try and reach an agreement with TALF. And they were concerned that they might not be able to get a bill through if we were actively opposing it. And that was their incentive to bargain with us on these matters. And we tried for a long time, but ultimately could not get agreement on provisions which would protect governance. And I'm not sure whether we ever got complete agreement on the provisions which would have appropriately, as we saw it, appropriately defined the bargaining unit so that each campus would be its own individual bargaining unit. That's what we wanted. Mm-hmm. They didn't like that. They didn't want that.
Did they understand? Did it seem to you that a true compromise between the two sides was a possibility?
Oh, we thought so for some time. Yeah, we tried.
And the ground was that you would have you would not be involved in the governance.
Well, the key issues were, first of all, what would be the bargaining unit? See, if you made the system faculty the bargaining, if you made the system the bargaining unit, then the Madison faculty could have been overwhelmed by the combination of people voting on other campuses. That was the risk. So we and the other Chapter 36 institutions, Green Bay, Parkside, Milwaukee, wanted each campus to have the right to decide individually through a vote of the campus faculty whether that campus would engage in collective bargaining. Because we were all convinced, and I think correctly so, that at the campus level, these former Chapter 36 institution faculties each would have defeated collective bargaining, mm-hmm. and we wanted them to have that freedom. Mm-hmm. We also wanted each of the other campuses to be able to make its own decision. But TALF would have, ideally, would have preferred to have the vote on collective bargaining be decided by a vote of the total faculty of all of the institutions in the system, so that if there was a majority there, everybody, all campuses, would be obliged to bargain collectively. And that was, you know, their ultimate position. And then there were compromise positions in between. And yes, we thought we could reach agreement on a compromise. And the other, or at least another key issue, was whether the governance system would be a permissible matter for collective bargaining, or whether bargaining over the existing governance structure would be prohibited. Because in collective bargaining, you have, first of all, some mandatory subjects of bargaining where the parties must bargain, like wages. And you have some other matters which the parties will bargain if they both agree to bargain them. Mm-hmm. And then you have some areas that are prohibited, excluded from collective bargaining. And we wanted governance to be excluded. TALF probably wanted it to be mandatory, but would have settled for permissive. I think they would have settled for permissive. And that, as I recall, was the other key issue where we were negotiating with TALF to see if we could reach a compromise. And for quite a while, we thought we could reach a compromise.
What eventually made it impossible to do so?
When push came to shove, we just couldn't agree. And there was some suspicion on our part that they were playing games with us.
Yeah, I read that in the minutes. Yeah. Why would they do that?
Because they thought that they were gaining strength in the legislature, and that if they could just keep us on a string, they could make progress in the legislature and get a bill through.
In terms of the university committee, I know that you were very much involved in it. I saw your name mentioned many times. Who are the other people on the committee that were heavily involved in this issue, or was everybody?
Well, everybody was somewhat involved with it. I didn't have an independent recollection, but in reading over your summary of the university committee minutes, as I remember from reading that over, John Rankin, who was on the committee the first year I was on, was involved, and later Steve Chafee was involved. I think maybe John Harriman may have been involved as well in these negotiations with TALF.
Now, I noticed, maybe I have this wrong, Anatole Beck was on the committee when you first joined.
Right.
He resigned. Was that over the collective, resigned from the university?
No, he was the person who went on leave the next year.
Okay. What about Chancellor Young? What was the nature of his involvement in these? Obviously, he was very interested in the outcome of these issues.
In the collective bargaining
matter?
Yeah,
in the collective bargaining matter.
Ed strongly supported the position that collective bargaining for faculty probably wasn't a good thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he took any particular role in the faculty's work on the matter. He probably worked with the regents in trying to convince members of the Board of Regents that they should not support a faculty collective bargaining bill. He probably worked with various people in state government who he knew to try and convince them. But he didn't have to do anything with the faculty.
Mm-hmm. What about the Board of Regents? We haven't really talked about them in this issue. Where did they stand?
Well, there was, as I recall, some division of opinion, but they ultimately took a position very much like the Madison faculty position of opposing a collective bargaining bill unless it contained certain protections relating to bargaining units and relating to governance. Oh, I forgot.
Where were we? Board of Regents.
We were talking about the Board of Regents. I remember that there was a meeting over at the Johnson Wax Foundation somewhere near Milwaukee. The
Wingspread
or whatever it's called. Board of Regents members and some faculty representatives to go over all these issues and collect and discuss the whole collective bargaining issue. Sometime during the period when I was on the university committee, the Board of Regents set that up. And generally speaking, I think the Board of Regents was quite supportive of the position that we ourselves were taking.
Who were some of the, who were some of the key players on TALF?
Ed Music, who was their executive director. He was a faculty member in one of the institutions. Who really was, as I recall, either half-time or full-time, the paid executive director of TALF, well before I got involved and well after. The other person I remember, whose name I remember, is Marshall Wick, who was at one of the Chapter 37 institutions. I don't remember which one. And there were a couple of other key players, but I don't remember their names.
How would you characterize, we talked a little bit about this earlier, the negotiations between the two sides? Was it pretty heated in there, or was it confrontative?
For the most part, I don't think it was very confrontational. There probably were some moments. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't great big meetings. It would be meetings of maybe three or four people to try and work something out.
I noticed near the end of the, I think about 2.5 years into your 3 years, you may or may not recall this, you did something with WHA television on the collective bargaining issue.
I don't remember that in particular, but I recall reading about it in the notes. Yeah.
You did a show on collective bargaining?
Apparently, yeah.
Okay.
We engaged in a lot of public relations activity, talked to lots of members of the legislature, and so on. That's when I first met Tommy Thompson. When he was, I think, minority leader in the Senate, and we talked to all kinds of people.
Who was governor at that time?
Lord, I don't remember.
Before Tony Earle. Earle was involved in that somewhat, but...
Of course, Earle was, I think, well after my time on the university committee.
Late 70s.
Pat Lucy may have been for part of this period. What's Mr. Red Vest's name?
Oh, Lee Dreyfus.
Lee Dreyfus may have been at part of that time. I don't remember beyond that.
What about some of the other major issues?
Well, there's more to the to collective bargaining.
Okay,
yeah.
Go ahead.
You will recall that one of the things that was started while I was chair of the university committee was meetings between representatives from the Madison University Committee and representatives from the governance structures at the other Chapter 36 institutions and from the center system and from the Oshkosh campus. And I don't remember what name we gave to that structure. But we decided to try and create this structure as a counter to TALF, to provide, because TALF would go around saying that it represented the faculty. And we wanted to make very clear that TALF did not represent the faculty. And we created this other institution which could speak on behalf of the faculties of the institutions that were part of this other structure. And a major impetus for doing this, of course, was on the collective bargaining issue, because that was the one that we were really fighting with TALF about in the legislature and public, and where we at that point had a feeling of a strong need of some structure that could speak not simply on behalf of one or another campus, but on behalf of these campuses as a collective body. And that worked pretty well. I guess that's the other major thing that spun off of the collective bargaining issue.
And as you said, this is an issue that you dealt with for your entire years on.
Oh, yeah.
When was it finally resolved?
Well, it's never been finally resolved in the sense that it can always come up again. That is, someone can always put forward a bill to authorize faculty collective bargaining. But I do not think there has been any really significant amount of support for this for a number of years now, though there still are bills that are proposed, but I don't think there's any real support. The governor opposes it. The Republicans generally oppose it. And there's a significant number of Democratic legislators who also oppose it, though, you know, this typically would be something that Democratic legislators would support, the right to bargain collectively.
Of course, you might also think, if you didn't know the governance structure in Madison, that this might be the kind of thing that Madison faculty would support because of the sort of pro-labor and...
Well, yeah, but that's an interesting question. Yeah, to the extent that the Madison faculty might be characterized as liberal, how come it doesn't adopt the traditional liberal position on collective bargaining? And you know, I think initially a lot of people who see themselves as liberals, myself included, the initial reaction is, well, hell, people ought to have the right to bargain collectively and they can decide if they want. But at least in terms of my own thinking about it, and I suspect that a fair number of people's thinking may have evolved in this fashion, if you come to see collective bargaining not as an end in itself, but really as a means toward an end, then you ask the question, well, is it a better means than what we presently have? And what are the ends? Well, the ends are to be able to have an effective voice in conditions of employment, wages and other conditions of employment, to have a meaningful say in university governance. If you approach it in that fashion, then there's a lot to the claim that what we presently have gives us a lot more say and a much better way of having a say in governance and in a variety of conditions of employment. We already control faculty appointments and tenure to a very large extent. You know, someone can't be hired without the faculty's vote. Someone can't get tenure without the faculty's vote. Lots of matters that are very important are largely governed by the faculty, and in lots of others matters, the faculty has a very large say along with the administration. The only issue on which Kauf could really argue that unionization might give you more vote, more voice, would be wages. And that wasn't much of an argument, because by and large, the decision that was made in state government about the wage package for faculty rather followed the decisions that they made about unionized employees in other spheres of state government. So our conclusion really was that you don't gain much by faculty governance. You create, to some extent, by collective bargaining, you create a more adversarial kind of relationship. And the means that we presently had was better than collective bargaining.
Was there a faction of the UW faculty that might have disagreed with that?
Oh, yeah, sure. There was a significant minority when we had Senate votes or took a poll of the whole faculty on issues. There was a significant minority that supported collective bargaining, partly because they supported collective bargaining, or some of them would have supported collective bargaining for the Madison campus. And some of them, although they may not have supported collective bargaining for the Madison campus, would have taken the position, but we should let the other campuses do it if they want to, even though we don't want to do it here.
By the way, I should mention for anybody listening to this tape that Ted has mentioned several times summaries of collective bargaining minutes. There will be copies of all of these in Ted's file in the Oral History Project. Which you can, of course, use as you listen to the tape. Moving on to some other issues the committee tackled during your years, any others that stand out in your mind?
The first issue that we confronted after I became chair in the late spring, beginning of the summer in 1974, had to do with it may have been called an ethics code. I think that's a misnomer. But it had to do and had provisions relating to outside activities by faculty and how much income faculty could earn on the outside. And this was a strange kind of situation, because there had been a committee that had some regents. I'm not quite sure who else, but also Clara Penniman, who was at that time chair of the university committee, the 1973-74 year. And they had worked out a proposal which had been acceptable to Clara, and this was now being brought to the regents for its approval. And when the rest of us saw it, we were really taken aback, because we thought it was terrible. But we were in a kind of difficult position, because here Clara had worked with some regents in developing this, and in particular, my goodness, I can't, Jack, I'm trying to remember the name of the regent. And I can't, his first name is Jack. And I, his second name begins with a P.
And sounds like.
And I can't. He's an attorney in Milwaukee.
Well, I could look that up. No.
Yeah, but anyway, he was then chair of the Board of Regents, and he had worked with Clara on this. Pelosek, right? Jack Pelosek. Good. When the committee saw this, it was somewhat aghast, because as I recall, it either required disclosure of what outside income was, or may also, in addition, may have put some limits on it. And our feeling was the university, and ergo the Board of Regents, has some legitimate interest in how much time we spend on outside activities, but no legitimate interest in how much money we make, providing that the activities themselves don't involve a conflict with university responsibilities. That is, they had a legitimate interest in time, because that could cut into the time we spent on university activities, and they had a legitimate interest in making sure that the substance of what we did outside, even though it was a small amount of time, the substance didn't create a conflict with our university responsibilities. But beyond that, it wasn't any of their business how much money we made. So I had the uncomfortable job of calling Jack Pelosek and telling him that although I was much embarrassed and I could understand why he might be rather annoyed, we were going to have to appear at the Board of Regents meeting and oppose this. We organized, in effect, faculty opposition. We believed that the faculty would be opposed to this, and we sent out a letter to all of the faculty explaining what was being proposed and what questions we saw, and asking the faculty to write us our opinions on this so we could present faculty sentiment to the Board of Regents. Well, we got mailbags of letters, which were virtually uniformly opposed, and we let the Board of Regents know. I let Jack know in advance what was coming, and I think they decided that given this strong faculty opposition, either it was a bad thing to do on the merits, or tactically it wasn't a wise thing to do, but they backed off of this, and there was some modified proposal that eventually was adopted. Now, that was a first.
That was very interesting.
Yeah, very. It was a very interesting and was a situation in which my whole involvement as a political animal in non-university politics served me quite well. And I got to know Jack Pelosek well in that, and I think, you know, the fact that I called him and was somewhat apologetic began to establish a good relationship between the two of us, which was very helpful during that whole year since he was chair of the Board of Regents.
How did Penniman get it to that point?
I don't know. I think Clara just probably simply thought that it was okay and didn't realize that it touched on some matters where the faculty would have a great deal of sensitivity, and probably didn't consult back on a regular basis with the university committee, with her colleagues on the university committee. Well, I'm sure of that because I was on the university committee during that year.
Anything else on the ethics?
No.
Okay. Another issue. What about affirmative action? Let's talk about that. Where was affirmative action when you joined the committee?
I don't know. That is, certainly affirmative action was a live issue in the sense that efforts had begun at some earlier date, exactly what date I don't know, to promote affirmative action hiring. There were the same concerns at that time as there continue to be today. On the one side, that the campus make a strong effort to recruit women and qualified women and minority faculty members. So I think there was very substantial support for doing this, but very substantial concern that quality standards not be diluted in this process. And of course, though, that tension continues to exist today to a lesser extent, since the more years that pass, the more women and minorities who are very well and highly qualified there are available for positions. But I think in at least in a number of academic areas, demand continues to exceed supply even today. Mm-hmm. That tension is still there.
I noticed in one of the things in the minutes, they mentioned that the Carnegie Commission on Higher Education had also issued a warning to not dilute the quality of education. Did the university? How did you handle that issue? Did you make any statements regarding it, or did you try to educate the faculty, or is it just something that was brought up?
I don't remember.
The name that comes across frequently in this whole issue is Serena Ponder.
Right.
And
Serena was an assistant chancellor. Ed Young had appointed Serena as an assistant chancellor in some significant part to be responsible for these very matters, especially on women's issues. I'm sure that Serena had other responsibilities as well, but this was one of her areas of responsibility.
Was she would you characterize her as a strong advocate for affirmative action?
Oh, yeah.
What about Young? Was he an advocate for it? Do you recall?
It's hard to tell with Ed Young. I don't think Ed would have appointed Serena unless he really wanted to see some progress. So I'm sure that he wanted to see some progress. How fast he wanted to move, where he saw the balance between wanting to hire, do more affirmative action hiring.
Not quite. Now we are.
Ed would have been concerned about the conflicting values. Serena would have had concern about them too. Ed was a very politically sensitive person. That is, he would have been concerned about the cross currents and wanting to handle things so as to avoid serious controversy, not at the expense of moving forward on affirmative action, and not at the expense of seriously impairing quality, but he wouldn't tell you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He would keep his own feelings much to himself.
When I read over, there were two or three pages of different references to affirmative action. One of the things that struck me is not much was really. It was mentioned and talked about in very general terms, but it didn't seem like anything was really done, any action was taken. But then there wasn't, first of all, am I correct in that? And secondly, there was an affirmative action committee appointed near the end. How did that come?
I can't answer the first question, how much was done. If you view this as the beginning, as the period in which beginnings were being made, not when I came on the committee as the beginning had started before, but still you've got a period of years in which the effort is just getting started. Although I can't really be concrete, my impression is that for a beginning period, there was a fair amount going on. that the minutes contain, you know, some references to study committees. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is always what happens in the first period of a movement. The committee that you mentioned, known by the acronym CNAFI, Committee on Non-Discrimination and Affirmative Action in Faculty Employment. For a while, I couldn't think of the acronym, but then it came to me. Was really one that I got started. Because I was firmly in support of affirmative action, concerned about the quality problem. Any sensible, reasonable person couldn't help but be concerned about that at the time. But I strongly supported the affirmative action move, and this was a committee that I suggested, and we organized and got adopted by the Senate as a standing faculty committee.
Serena Pondrum was obviously a key player in this. You were with your position on the university committee and developing this committee. Were there any other key players that you can recall involved in this affirmative, in the early years of the affirmative action movement?
Well, there were other, if you think about affirmative action as part of, so to speak, the women's movement, then I can think of other, actually the notes from the minutes jog my memory about a couple of people, women faculty, who were active in developing a women's studies program and eventually a department. Can't think of her first name, Penniman.
Penniman, yeah.
Yeah, and Jane Pilyaman.
Pilyaman, right.
Were quite important people at that time, and Serena was very important. And I'm sure that there were a number of other faculty women who were quite active in the whole thing. I just don't remember the name.
Cora Merritt is one of them.
Oh, Cora, right.
I see Bri Curl in there a lot, too. Do you remember him?
Well, at some point, Bri was in an administrative position. Now, I can't put my finger on the.
Another person who's mentioned at least a couple times in affirmative action, many times in collective bargaining, and is a person I know is an important person in this period, but I just don't know much about it, was Ray Bowen. Can you talk about Ray for a second?
As I remember, Ray had been a member of the university committee at one point. I think Ray may have been chair of the university committee. That was before my membership on the committee, and I think Ray was, maybe the title was an associate vice chancellor, but he had an administrative position of some sort in Bascom, which was the source of his involvement.
Sort of spin-offs, we're not going to touch them today, but we'll hit them next time, are some of the ethnic and gender studies departments that came about at the same time. That seemed to be a real formative time in the development of these different units on campus.
This is the tail end of movements that began in the 60s.
Yeah, the late. The other thing I wanted to just comment on for the record here is I was just really impressed at how often I found phrases like the chancellor stopped in, he stayed for 15 minutes. And then he left. I mean, the notes really give you a good indication of the flexibility and the style of the administration and of the committee.
Yeah.
And I would really urge people who are listening to this to not only read the sections on collective bargaining, et cetera, that I've pulled out, but I also have a copy of summary of the minutes, which will take an hour to read, but I think is worth the time.
Well, Ed Young recognized, as well as
anybody ever does, I think, the importance of personal relationships. And just as he made it a point to invite me when I was chair to have lunch with him on a regular basis once a week, whether there was anything to talk about or not. So he made it a regular practice to come in and chat with the university committee whether there was anything to talk about or not. He was and remains a very wise political animal and good administrator. Yeah. Good. Have a lot of affection for Ed Young.
Good place to end today's session.